Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Central College and Humanities Iowa, presenting the new podcast Mid-Americana, Stories from a Changing Midwest. New episodes from Season 1 are available at midamericana.com or wherever podcasts are found.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A week ago, on Friday, Mark Cady, Chief Justice of the Iowa Supreme Court, died unexpectedly of a heart attack. He was 66 years old. Cady served on the Iowa Supreme Court since 1998. He is well known for writing that 2009 court opinion that made Iowa the third state to permit same-sex marriages. Justice David Wiggins will serve as acting Chief Justice until the current vacancy on the court is filled and a Chief Justice is selected by the fully constituted court. Joining me now to remember Mark Cady, former Chief Justice of the Iowa Supreme Court, Marcia Ternus. Justice Ternus, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ben.
I want to also disclose that you are also president of the IPR board. I want to express our heartfelt condolences for this loss. I wonder if you could share your thoughts about his sudden passing.
Well, I was as stunned and shocked as everyone else was, and terribly saddened to see his career ended in this unexpected way. He had just been installed as the president of the Conference of Chief Justices, which is a huge honor. And I'm saddened that he didn't get to finish his term and carry on with the priorities that he had, which were all very important to Iowans.
Mm-hmm. You spoke about Mark Cady during a celebration of his life, a ceremony for him on Wednesday at Drake University. I wonder if you could share a little bit about the mood there, what you experienced, and the highlights you brought out about this man.
Well, I think in general, it was a pretty sad event, but at the same time, there was so much to celebrate about Mark's life, and not just his professional life, but Mark as a person. He was a wonderful man. It's hard to imagine him meeting somebody who wouldn't remark on his kindness and humanity. So there were a lot of wonderful stories. And I was very, very honored to be one of the individuals to reflect on his career.
Mm-hmm. He was on this program several times, in fact, just this year, to remember the passing of other former Iowa Supreme Court justices. Indeed, such a kind man with such kind words for others, a joy and a great storyteller as well. I wonder if you can point to an instance, something he said or did that communicates, gets to the heart of who he was as a person, his character.
Well, I think I might talk a little bit about how he made decisions.
Mm-hmm.
He was very principled, very methodical. When we had an issue come before the court, he would read the briefs, become familiar with the facts, very meticulously review our prior cases and any statutory laws that might apply, and then engage in a legal analysis to reach the right answer. So he was very committed to the law, the rule of law, the law guiding him to the correct decision. He didn't come with any preconceived ideas, any, commitment to a judicial philosophy. He was very, I'll just say again, he was very committed to the rule of law.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned at the outset, he's best known for authoring the Varnum decision that came out in April of 2009. You were then Chief Justice. It made Iowa only the third state in the nation to allow same-sex marriage. A difficult time, certainly for you as Chief Justice and fellow justices following that decision. We We remind ourselves that groups opposed to same-sex marriage organized a campaign against you, also against Justice Baker and Streit. You happened to be up for retention and were dismissed by voters in 2010. How did Mark Cady come to author the Varnum decision?
It was really by chance. We drew our case assignments that month out of a bag. And we had written the, my secretary had written the names of the cases that were going to be argued that month on separate slips of paper, had put them into the bag, brought that into the conference room, and then we each pulled out a slip of paper to find out what case would be assigned to us. So it was totally random. He put his hand in, he pulled out a slip of paper, and he said, Varnum versus Breen, and that's how it happened. Mm-hmm. I will say, Iowa was fortunate that he was the one to draw that case.
Why?
Well, I think he's a great writer. As I said, he was very principled in his decision-making. Obviously, it was a unanimous decision, but I think his methodical way of making decisions was reflected in the way he drafted the opinion. I thought he also wrote quite eloquently about the context within which we made our decision, describing the history of the Iowa Supreme Court and upholding Iowan civil rights, describing in very human terms the plaintiffs that were before the court. And I think he also made, well, I know he also made a considerable effort to write the court's opinion in a manner that could be readily understood, not just by lawyers who were familiar with legal terminology, but by any Iowan who wrote it. And I might say that that is perhaps a reflection of one of the outstanding qualities of Mark Cady, and that was that he viewed the courts as there for the people, which mm-hmm. they are, but that permeated his approach to his job and to the priorities he set in the administration of the courts.
And in fact, after that decision, after the retention vote in 2010, perhaps before it, I mean, he saw it fit to take the oral arguments on the road to Iowa communities so that there was less of a distance between the people of Iowa and its highest court, right?
That's exactly right. And that, again, is a reflection of his desire that people understand how the courts operate, that they are accessible to all citizens, all Iowans, and that the courts are there for them.
Mm-hmm. So many other things that he represented, so many good things that he championed here, juvenile justice reform. He was distressed by the disproportionate minority representation in our state criminal justice system. So many things. In closing, what else needs to be mentioned in the short time that we have here, Justice Ternus?
I think one laudable characteristic of Mark is that he was the same person, whether he was at a sporting event with friends or whether he was talking to students after one of the court's oral arguments, you know, on the road, or when he was in the conference room discussing a case with his colleagues. He was a thoughtful, considerate man, and he had great compassion for everyone. He was also so committed to equal and accessible justice, and I think those are all attributes of Chief Justice Cady that I hope we remember over the years.
Mm, thank you so much, Justice Ternus. I wanted to just comment on a little outtake from a Des Moines Register article recounting a student recently asking Mark Cady during a panel discussion to explain what makes a good lawyer. The question, should they be more aggressive, more clever, talk in a certain way? The answer, according to this report from Cady, his answer, I find the best course is to be a good person.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he would say that.
Marcia Ternus, thank you so much for this time and helping us remember a great man in Iowa, Chief Justice Mark Cady, who died a week ago.
You're welcome, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's quickly get an idea of what happens now to fill that Iowa Supreme Court vacancy with the sudden death of Chief Justice Mark Cady. Todd Pettis joins us by phone, the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation, Professor of Law at the University of Iowa. Todd Pettis, welcome back to our program. Certainly sad. Mark Cady, a big figure, an important figure in Iowa legal history.
He certainly was. I'm always happy to talk to you, but I'm heartbroken that this is the occasion. He was really a superb justice, and by all accounts from everyone who knew him, really a superb human being, and a huge, huge loss.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk about the Iowa Supreme Court and filling that vacancy. What happens now?
Well, under state law, the governor has 10 days roughly to call for a meeting of this, what's called the State Judicial Nominating Commission. That's a group of 17 people, nine of them appointed by the governor now under new legislation that came down earlier this year. So nine governor appointees and then eight attorneys elected by other attorneys in the state. So those 17 people will have 2 months, 60 days, to solicit applications, review those applications, interview candidates, and then come to some agreement on, by majority vote, on three finalist names. Those three finalist names then go to the governor. And so if you figure roughly 2 months from now, this is late November, so that takes us to late January. So sometime around the end of January, late January, the commission shall have wrapped up its work, if not a little sooner. Those names then go to the governor, and she has 30 days to pick the winner, if you will, or the new justice.
Mm-hmm. In the meantime, I understand Justice David Wiggins will serve as acting Chief Justice until that is put in place, the new vacancy filled and the new justice, Chief Justice, selected by the fully constituted court. I wonder, you said this new law is in action. The process you described, does that necessarily mean that the governor will be able, when we compare it with the former way it was done, a more conservative justice, more likely to be able to put a justice of her choosing in that position?
Yeah, well, some things have changed and some things have not changed. One thing that has not changed is the governor has to choose from the list of three names that she's presented with. That's in our state constitution. So that remains the same. The thing that has changed is that the composition of the body is 17 people now. That is now controlled, and they operate by majority vote. And a majority now, nine of the 17, are appointed by the governor. Those commissioners are not at all obligated to vote. They're emphatically not obligated to vote as a block, or they don't owe any official loyalty to anybody. You know, they're each going to make their own judgment. But as a factual matter, the governor's appointees now do control that process. And so if those governor appointees or some collection of governor appointees plus Iowa bar members, if a majority settles on a slate that is kind of uniformly conservative in nature, she will be picking from that list. Mm-hmm. If they were to pick a slate that was kind of more middle of the road or lean to the left, she has to pick from that list. And if there's diversity on the panel, she'll then choose her preference. One reason why the law was changed by those articulated by those who wanted the change was that in some years past, you know, there'd be people on that slate of three that go to the governor who might be non-starters with the governor. Mm-hmm. And so there was some notion that, by making these changes, by having the governor's own appointees on the controlling the group that makes the choices, the odds are higher that the governor will kind of look from the top to the bottom of that three-person list and say, wow, these are all great people. Now, which one do I want? Instead of, well, here's one or two people that are being forced on me. I'm never going to pick them, so I've got to go with this other person.
Okay, it sounds like, Todd, we can't predict whether we'll have a more conservative court with this vacancy filling. We'll have to check back in with you, I guess, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, a lot of people are saying the court will move to the right, but you know, there's a lot of ifs in that. It's an easy prediction to make, but there are a lot of ifs, and so we'll see what happens. We should know by late February who the new person is.
Okay, Todd Pettis of the University of Iowa College of Law. Todd, thanks for joining us and explaining this to us.
My pleasure. Thanks for taking time with me.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, as we know, Iowa has no Major League Baseball teams. But this week, news that could impact fans of minor league baseball here in the state. Earlier in the week, Major League Baseball released its renegotiation plan of the current professional baseball agreement with minor league baseball. Now, under this proposed plan, Major League Baseball would strip 42 minor league ball teams of their affiliation with their affiliation status with the Major League Baseball. Now, this would establish, they say, independent leagues known as Dream Leagues. Three of these 42 teams in the proposal are Class A teams here in Iowa. They include the Quad City River Bandits, the Burlington Bees, and the Clinton Lumber Kings of the Midwest League. Noteworthy, the Cedar Rapids Colonels and the Iowa Cubs did not appear on this list. We contacted Major League Baseball's Vice President of Communications, Michael Tevan, for comment on these negotiations, and he said that this renegotiation is, quote, not an elimination, end quote, of these teams. Now, Minor League Baseball's Senior Director of Communications, Jeff Lance, sees the phrase elimination differently.
I mean, the independent model is really hard to maintain, and especially if the team has to pay a lease on a ballpark. You look at the Kansas City T-Bones, I think they just folded or shut down operations because they fell so far behind on lease payments. But, saying that they're not eliminating, they're just giving them a chance to be in this independent league, that it's a business model that's destined for failure, which makes it basically a death sentence for these teams that are on the list.
A death sentence? Wow. Joining us to unpack this professional baseball agreement renegotiation and what it might mean for three Iowa teams, Daniel Finney, storyteller at the Des Moines Register. He's been writing about it. Hi, Daniel. Thanks for coming into the studio.
A pleasure to be here.
Why is this happening?
Major League Baseball says that what they want is to streamline the player development process. They want to get their prospects ready faster, and there's also the metrics group of people, the super sabermaticians and whatnot. And what they've come up with is an idea that they believe that some of the smaller market A-ball teams, and I think a couple of AA-ball teams, are getting in the way of players developing for the majors faster.
And it's also budgetary, right? They have to pay money to maintain these minor league teams.
They do, although I think the minor league teams would contend very strongly that the amount of money that they pay to maintain the team itself, setting aside the salary, which of course the parent clubs pay, setting that aside, their investment in the local community is minimal. For example, I talked to the general manager of the Clinton Lumber Kings, and he said that outside of salaries, their investment in the ball club, which is owned by the community of Clinton, was about $600,000 a year. Well, by comparison, the minimum salary for a major league player is $550,000. So their argument is it's not a financial issue for Major League Baseball.
Mm-hmm. So there would be these new leagues created, Dream Leagues. If this goes through, what does this mean potentially for teams that would find themselves in this new independent, these new independent leagues known as Dream Leagues?
Two things. The quality of independent league baseball would increase, but the quality of baseball which you, the fan, would pay to watch will decrease. So there'll be better players in independent leagues, players that have been cut from major league rosters, players who went undrafted who were pretty good but not quite as good. But the kids who've been signed, some of them to big contracts, the next up-and-comers, you're not going to see them. I also think it would be a true blow to the self-esteem of the communities that have these A-ball franchises. I think it's another way that metropolitan America says to rural America, you're not as important as we are.
But that comment there we heard from Jeff Lance, a death sentence. You don't seem to be going that far.
I'm a reporter and not an advocate either way, so it would be inappropriate for me to say that. I think that it's within the realm of possibility that if you say we're going to take away the major league funding and create what at this point is sort of an amorphous idea of the Dream Leagues, that I think some of the very small markets, I believe Clinton is the smallest A-ball market, would just not be able to sustain a professional baseball team.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that that is certainly a possibility.
Before we say goodbye, this is a renegotiation plan. What are you watching next?
Well, the current professional baseball agreement doesn't expire until the end of the 2020 season. So what we know is these are always, negotiations are always in flux. So what I don't know is how committed Major League Baseball is to getting rid of 42 minor league teams. And I don't know how strong minor league baseball's negotiating point is. My what I've been told is that the minor league baseball clubs, all 160 of them, are united in the idea that this is bad for baseball. But the key thing to watch is how these negotiations play out. A lot of that's closed doors, private business, but there will be more news as the season develops.
All right, Daniel Finney, thanks for coming into the studio of the Des Moines Register, talking about how three Iowa minor league baseball teams at risk of losing their major league affiliate status. Daniel, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
Coming up after a short break, we'll talk about a new poll that shows President Trump's popularity is rising here in Iowa among Republicans. Katie Pikus tells us about a protest at a Denison high school and an avalanche of advice from Iowa Public Radio listeners on how to cope with Iowa winters. That's still to come on this News Buzz edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Central College and Humanities Iowa, presenting the new podcast Mid-Americana, Stories from a Changing Midwest. New episodes from Season 1 are available at midamericana.com or wherever podcasts are found.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, President Trump enjoys widespread popularity among registered Republicans here in Iowa. That's according to a new Des Moines Register CNN MediaCom Iowa poll. Joining us with details, Breanne Funnensteel, chief politics reporter for the Des Moines Register. Breanne, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Hey, I just wanted to mention the poll is a little 502 registered Iowa Republicans who do not plan to attend the Democratic caucuses next year, conducted earlier this month by Selzer and Company. Margin of error of about 4 percentage points. What questions were asked?
So we polled on job approval, his favorability, how Republicans plan to vote in the next election, just to get a sense of how he's doing among his supporters, among registered Republicans. And so his job approval has ticked up to about 85%. That's up a little bit from March. 76% say they will definitely vote to reelect him. That's up 9 points. His favorability is at 83%. So, I mean, frankly, he's the most popular Republican that we tested in this field. He did better across the board than Senator Chuck Grassley, Senator Joni Ernst, and Governor Kim Reynolds.
Mm-hmm. How much of a surprise was this to you?
Well, it's a little bit of a surprise because I think as we pay attention to this news cycle day in and day out, you know, he's got issues with ethanol. We're following conversations about foreign policy and as impeachment is happening. But I think if you're out and you're at some of these Republican events where you're talking to his supporters, I don't know that it's much of a surprise. What we hear and what we've been hearing is that Republicans, by and large, really like a lot of the things that he's doing, even if they take issue with maybe the way that he does it or the way that he talks or rather tweets about it.
Mm-hmm. How much of this do you think is due to the robust economy?
I think quite a bit. You know, we tried to kind of drill down into some of the issues and we asked for approval about the way he's handling specific aspects of the job, you know, and on the economy, 89% say they approve of that. On immigration, it's 76%. Trade with China is 75%, foreign policy is 74%. So across those issues, people, these Republicans rather, feel really strongly about the way he's doing. You know, where he does have something of a weak spot is his handling of the ethanol situation. Just a small majority, 53%, approve of his handling of that situation.
Brianne, I thought it was interesting in this poll that you brought out that these Republicans are very confident that Donald Trump will get a second term, more confident than Democrats are in, well, any of their possible candidates, right?
It was a really striking difference. You know, we poll on the Democrats, and when we asked them, are these candidates almost certain to beat Donald Trump? Joe Biden did best, but just 25% said they were almost certain he would win. And when we look at Republicans, they're far more confident in the president's ability. They're most certain they can defeat Senator Bernie Sanders. 62% say the president is almost certain to win in that case. But majorities say that they could win against all four of the current leaders. 59% say he's almost certain to beat Senator Warren. 58% say they're almost certain to beat Vice President Biden. And 56% say they're almost certain to beat Mayor Pete Buttigieg.
You also ask about the Republican Party's 2012 nominee for president to see how favorable this group was to U.S. Senator, now U.S. Senator Mitt Romney.
Right. His numbers have really fallen over the past several years. And in part, you know, we didn't ask about this, but I think you can read into the numbers a little bit that Senator Romney now has really positioned himself in contrast with the president on some occasions. And as the president's popularity is so high, I think those folks who have positioned themselves against him do not fare well in our poll. We also tested some of the other Republicans who've thrown their hat in the ring in a primary sense, and they also did quite poorly as far as favorability here in Iowa.
I wonder if this could have been interpreted as, if you see it as, well, Mitt Romney and the others representing the traditional older form of the Republican Party, that we can see in these poll findings as well that this is really Trump's party now.
It is. One question that I thought was really fascinating, we asked whether these Republicans feel more loyalty to the president or to the Republican Party, to kind of get into this point that you're making. You know, what is this, the party of Donald Trump? And 41% say they feel more loyalty to Donald Trump right now. And that's about what we see as far as loyalty to the Republican Party. 43% say they're more loyal to the party. And you do see some differences among demographics there. Young people and those with college degrees are more likely to align with the party. Those who describe themselves as very conservative or evangelical are more likely to align with the president. But it's a really fairly even split down the middle of how these Republicans are seeing their allegiance.
Fascinating poll results. Thank you for explaining them a little bit to us. Brianne Fonensteel, Chief Politics Reporter for the Des Moines Register. Nice to talk with you, Brianne. Until next time.
Thanks again.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, let's turn to the western part of the state where this week students from Denison High School walked out of their classes in protest. IPR's Western Iowa reporter Katie Pikus is with us. Hi, Katie.
Hey, Ben.
How did this all start?
Well, it started when last Friday, Denison Community Schools posted a Facebook post saying that one of their teachers was under investigation for using a derogatory term, a racial slur. And the story started to unfold, and there was a recording that was released online showing that she was using the racial slur, and she was justifying using the racial slur in a historical context in a class where they were kind of studying the death penalty and working on looking at a case on
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm. And the slur was the N-word.
The slur was the N-word.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there was a recording of her discussing this in class, and the students objected to it. Why?
The students said that that term should never be used, ever, and the teacher said this is a historical context. If you understand the historical context, it is okay to use this word in this historical context to teach history, essentially.
Mm, okay, but then how does the protest figure in? When did that happen?
Well, the protest happened on Tuesday morning. Students walked out of classes for a little bit, and the school district was investigating the matter internally, but students were saying that there's issues that go beyond this particular one, and they were calling for an external investigation into racism and diversity issues in the school.
You collected a little bit of sound from that protest. Tell us what we're about to hear.
Yeah, so Christopher Espino was at the protest, and he was in this second class that the teacher Crystal Holt taught, where she was brought in to justify her use of the N-word in the first class.
We are walking out simply to show that we want change in our school system. The next thing we want is justice. What we want is a change in our policies and a change and how we handle racism and derogatory terms used in our school.
Okay, sounds like quite a group there protesting outside of Denison High School. Pick up the narrative. What happened then?
So they protested during that morning, during classes, and later in the day, there was a school board meeting, and people really packed that school board meeting. There were dozens and dozens of people. More than 20 people from the community actually spoke and gave public comments to the school board. And most of the comments were actually in support for the teacher, Crystal Holt. And a lot of people said, you know, how much she's helped them, how great a teacher she's been, or how great she's been in the community. And we also heard a couple of accounts of what happened in class. We heard people say that they believe she used the word without any intention or harm. And yeah, those were kind of the gist of the comments we heard.
Mm-hmm. In the last minute we have to talk here, Katie, bring us up to date, because there's been some developments here within the last 24 hours.
There have been, and even in the last 12 to 15 hours, the Denison Community School District released a statement last night determining that it finished its investigation and that the teacher, Crystal Holt, had no malicious intent when she used the racial slur. And as a result of the investigation, the school district said that it's putting together a sort of a cultural advisory committee to basically make sure that the learning environment is free from cultural bias from now on.
Okay, IPR's Western Iowa reporter following this story this week, Katie Pikus, thanks for the latest.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Joining me in the studio now, our most recently hired IPR talk show producer, Matt Alvarez. Hi, Matt.
Hey, Ben.
Matt, I've just got one thing to say to you.
You were born in the long summer. You've never known anything else. But now winter is truly coming. And in the winter, we must protect ourselves.
Okay. I wish my Sean Bean Game of Thrones impersonation was that good. But that was actually a clip of Sean Bean as Lord Stark in Game of Thrones. It's our Winter Coach series here on River to River, Occasional Conversations with Matt Alvarez. Matt Alvarez, not only our shiny new producer here at Iowa Public Radio, but he is a native Texan who has never been exposed to a Midwest winter. He has never had never been exposed to 0 degrees Fahrenheit until a couple of weeks ago when we had that deep dive in the temperatures here in the Midwest. And he is asking for your help and mine to coach him through his first Iowa winter. And we asked a couple of weeks ago for help for you. What an outpouring of tips from Iowans.
I mean, Iowa nice. That's what everyone told me when I moved here.
And Iowa nice and Iowa keep warm. What kind of comments did we get?
Well, man, first of all, over 70 emails that I received on just great pieces of advice. If I could summarize everything, wool socks, wool everything.
You cannot beat natural fibers. I found that to be true. Good advice. Go on.
Yak tracks, the kind of stuff that you put on the bottom of your feet so you can, maneuver, get around and
not break bones.
Yeah, yeah. And layers, which I was always told as a kid when it was cold, but I mean, you know, this is a different type of cold. Whole layers. I had to wear a vest and a down jacket and sweaters and thermal clothing underneath all my other clothes. I still managed to get to work on those cold days.
Your bike, you're commuting to work on a bike.
Mm-hmm. It's just good. A lot faster than walking for
me. You've
got
a mile or so to commute, right?
It's about a mile. And I go a little bit slower when it's wet outside or when it's snowing and it's a little slushy. It typically just takes me about 8 to 10 minutes on a dry day. But on those days, I give myself an extra 20 minutes to get to work so I can slowly get here safely. But you know, reading through some of the advice, it sort of did help and it prepared me a little bit. One thing that I read right off the bat, you've officially been baptized. This is what Blair said on Facebook.
Blair, all right.
I've been baptized as an Iowan by our weather. Laugh out loud. My advice, layer, layer, layer in all caps. I'll be sure to remember that through the rest of winter.
And you do know you've experienced an early dip in the temperatures and an early snow. This is a bit unusual for us. Sometimes it's not unusual for us to not even have snow by Thanksgiving. That will happen occasionally, but we've had it well before Thanksgiving and temperatures down to zero or even below couple of weeks ago.
It was a nice little sample of what's to come. Rose kind of scared me a little bit. She said ice. Essentially a lethal weapon. White, black, chunks, or smooth. This stuff can kill you whether you walk, bike, or drive. And it was one of those things that I read in the morning. First thing that I got into work, and I was like, oh no. Yeah, because I haven't experienced ice just yet. But a lot of the other stuff was great. Stephanie told me to keep, you know, an emergency kit of warm stuff in my car, blankets, a beanie, gloves, just in case I get stranded or stuck somewhere.
Very good advice.
Brent told me about what type of tires I should get for my car, all season or winter tires. He says since I'm in Iowa City, all season tires can do well. Leia told me to make sure I brush off the snow off the roof of my car, which I had not been doing up to this day. Al from Eldon, Iowa, said to trade in my bike for a four-wheel F-350. Yeah, and Jolene pretty much just told me, sorry, Iowa winters are a bit like childbirth. No matter how much information you gather, you simply have to experience it for yourself.
All right. Well, it sounds like some great advice. Let's make sure our listeners know they can continue to give you winter coaching advice by emailing Iowa River to River at iowapublicradio.org and checking in with the social media. You are on Twitter at Matt Alvarez on Air. You can find me on Twitter at IPR Ben or follow Iowa Public Radio. I have a little gift for you in conclusion here, Matt.
Sweet.
It's a little
Letter, and this reads, Ben's Winter DEFCON Scale for Winter Biking Community.
Okay, a little bit of explanation here. I am a Cold War baby, so I understand threats in terms of DEFCON ratings. Of course, that's the military term for defense readiness in our country. But I'm talking about individual readiness when it comes to cold here. So your DEFCON 5 is your lightest, your easy peasy, pleasant winter driving conditions or biking conditions, since you are biking throughout the winter, we hope, down to DEFCON 1. Then you hopefully, or you may be, like Matt Damon on Mars. You should be clothed similarly to Matt Damon on Mars because their frostbite or worse is a real threat. So there's a little scale.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps you can refer to it before you step out the door, before you get on your bike, to make sure that you are clothed and you have the gear ready for your bike commute through these winter months.
Yeah. Well, this is certainly helpful. And, you know, I'm going to put it right next to my door right before I leave. And I check the temperature and the wind chill.
And we'll be sharing that scale with our social media. You can follow Iowa Public Radio on Twitter. We'll also be putting that out on Facebook, I think, too, as well, Matt.
Yes, we will.
Okay. Until our next update for Winter Coach. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you, Ben.
And as we finish up this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, it's a good time to check out the weather forecast. Let's talk with Jeff Zog of the National Weather Service in Des Moines. He's a meteorologist there. Hi, Jeff.
Hi there, Ben. How are you doing today?
I'm doing really well. Tell us about the next few days weather-wise across Iowa and the Midwest.
Well, Ben, the next few days we're going to gradually warm up over the weekend. Today is a relatively cool day, below normal temperatures, but it'll be a little bit warmer on Saturday and a little bit warmer on Sunday. But then the focus turns to the early part of next week with a potential storm system that may affect Thanksgiving travel.
Oh, tell us more about this storm system. What's happening?
Sure. Well, earlier this week, our models were indicating the potential for an impactful storm for Thanksgiving travel. Yesterday, they backed off a little bit, suggested it wouldn't be that big of a deal. And now overnight, they're coming back in and suggesting that storm may actually materialize after all. So we're taking a look at it again today to see what potential impacts it may have on travel. The exact track of this storm system is still unknown at this time. Could bring anything from rain to snow across Iowa, especially depending on where you live. So we'll just have to keep an eye on things and continue evaluating our models.
Oh, wow. Okay, certainly keep an eye for travelers during the Thanksgiving week, an eye on the weather. Other parts of the country that you're looking at or maybe aware of, people traveling long car trips typically during this time sometimes.
That's exactly right, Ben, and it looks like especially the eastern part of the United States is going to be affected by one, if not two, storm systems next week, potential for rain and thunderstorms depending on where you're at, and again, depending on where you're at in this part of the country, potentially snowfall. So we urge people planning travel for Thanksgiving to keep an eye on the latest forecast. It could change day to day. Like I said, we're evaluating that information day by day and trying to put the best forecast out there so people can make their plans.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're coming to the end of November here, and of course we had that real cold burst of temperatures a few days in early November. How would you characterize the winter so far?
Well, the winter so far, Ben, officially hasn't even started. We're still in fall, so
okay.
Although we've had winter-like temperatures, we're still in fall.
Uh-huh.
Temperatures, earlier this week warmed up to, right around 60 in Des Moines, with even some slightly warmer temperatures across southwest Iowa, cooler across northeast Iowa, but they were above normal. Cooled off again, but we're looking for a return to near-normal temperatures by the end of the weekend, so quite a variation in temperatures so far this fall, especially over the past week or so.
Yeah, a few days ago, a couple of weeks ago, what was that really serious drop in temperature that where we, in some parts of Iowa, we got even below zero Fahrenheit?
Yes, we did. It was very unusual to see temperatures that low for this time of year. Definitely winter-like, and of course, a lot of the state received snowfall in conjunction with those cold temperatures. Just a Arctic plunge came down into Iowa, but thankfully temperatures moderated, and like I said, we had some relatively warm temperatures, even above normal temperatures, the middle part of this week, earlier this week. So.
Okay, and once again, Jeff, what you said a minute ago, people should keep an eye on the weather, especially if they're traveling next week, right?
That's exactly right, Ben. We're evaluating our model output day by day. Things can change day by day, even over the weekend, so we urge travelers that are planning travel next week to stay tuned to the latest forecast so they can make their plans accordingly.
Okay, Jeff Zog, the National Weather Service in Des Moines, meteorologist. Jeff, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Temperatures in the mid-30s across the state now. Let's warm up by grooving into the weekend finally here with Tony Daner, IPR Studio One host. Hi, Tony.
Hey, Ben.
Warm us up. What do you got?
Yeah, here's a good one from Grace Potter, a singer who thought she was done making music not too long ago after some life changes. But she did what songwriters do after big life changes, started writing songs. And the result is this new album called Daylight, and it includes this one called On My Way.
Ooh, I like Grace's howl there, if you would call it that, Tony. One more. We've got time for it. What do you got for us?
Okay, Charlie Bliss, a super fun power pop band from Brooklyn. They put out a record earlier this year, but had some leftover songs and decided to release them. This new EP is called Supermoon, and this is the title track. It's Charlie Bliss.
Make sure you tune in to IPR Studio One with Tony Daner, Mark Simmet, and the rest of the gang. Tony, thank you for grooving us into the weekend.
Anytime, Ben.